Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
And the name of the show is The Shame Free Zone. It doesn't say a thing about sexual shame, although that has been the focus over the last year. But that's going to be changing here pretty quick. We've got a documentary about domestic violence due to air in November. And to kick off our departure from sexual shame into anything about shame, today I have invited Michael Joseph, who is the holistic nutrition consultant over at the Staff of Life Nutrition. He also happens to be the founder of the Staff of Life Nutrition Consulting. And the title that I'm really particularly enamored with is Food Sensualist. So today we're going to be talking about guilt, shame, and judgment as it pertains to food and eating. Michael, welcome to the Shame Free Zone.
Thank you, Veronica. It's great to be here.
I'm really glad to have you here, and you are just a magnet for people. We've already got a caller. Caller, can you hear us?
Hi, yeah, I can hear you.
Can you tell us your name?
My name is David Nakaba.
Hey, David. Do you have a question or a comment about food and shame today, or have you brought us another topic?
I don't have a question or comment. I am Michael's business partner, and I wanted to call in and just be here on the radio show.
Oh, well, awesome. We probably will have you on for a little bit, and then I'm going to have to ask you to free up the lines for other callers, but happy to have you contribute to the show. And I didn't know that Michael had a business partner, so welcome.
Well, David is David and I are working on a lot of things, and it's great for him to stop over and to say hello. He promised he would call, and I think that's really great. We have a whole like East Coast contingent right now that is starting to learn a little bit more about eliminating guilt and judgment in their food decisions. So David has been very supportive about this, and I'm really excited that he called in because this is a very interesting topic.
Well, I have to tell you, Michael, and David, right? Did I get...
Yes. Okay.
So, Michael and David, both of you, I'm really excited about this because usually when I am hearing about removing shame and guilt around food, a lot of the message seems to be coming from people that I might define as something other than fit or healthy. David, I haven't seen any pictures of you, but I know Michael is absolutely in top, you know, fitness condition. I mean, he's very, very fit, very healthy, just exudes health. And to have somebody who's very health conscious talking about food as a sensual experience, to me, it sounds like a totally new paradigm. I can't say that I have seen or heard or read much about this at all. So, Michael, I'd like to ask you, how did you come across this concept, or you know, what pushed this paradigm for you?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think I kind of embarked on this because when I started working with my clients about 7 or 8 years ago, I had a lot of people kind of approaching me with this idea that they were doing something really bad. That they would sit there and say, "Oh God, I was so bad today. I ate chocolate cake, or I had a hamburger." And then I started working with some different types of food organizations that were, like vegetarian organizations. And there was this pervasive idea that if you ate something that was not necessarily fitting into a particular ideology, there was this enormous amount of guilt that was rained down on you for that. I experienced it with, across the board, from the hardcore carnivores, from the Atkins camp and the high protein diets, all the way down to the raw foodists. Everywhere I went, there was always somebody that was saying to me, "Oh, well, that's bad. That's good. That's bad. That's good." And I'm like, "Well, who are you to say what's good and bad?" And then I started to get more involved in allergy testing, and I had reports coming back for different people where it wouldn't fit into any one particular dogmatic ideology. So I had to be much more specified with how I worked with somebody. And, you know, if it turned out that they were someone that, came back with certain allergies to foods, which would be in the media that were supposedly super healthy foods, like, for instance, soybean. I'm horrifically allergic to soybean, so the next best alternative for me would be grains, which are universally slammed now because the carbohydrates from the high-protein people, and meat, which is universally slammed by the vegetarian people. So I can't have soybean, and I can't have dairy, and I can't have certain tree nuts because I'm allergic to them. And so here I am kind of stuck in the middle, and the only thing I want to do is sit down and have a meal and enjoy myself in a way that's unique and individual to myself. And I try to teach that to my clients, where we get much more specific about what works for somebody and what doesn't, and then try to create a fun, adventurous experience in learning about new foods and experiencing food for what it really is, which is to nourish and strengthen your body, and not necessarily something to promote some sort of dogma or ideology.
Well, you know, Michael, your path, I certainly didn't come to the same conclusions that you did. I think I've just continued to feel the sting of all that shame and guilt surrounding food. And people certainly are judgmental about your eating choices. If I'm hanging around my vegetarian friends, then they're horrified that I'm eating white fish. And if I'm hanging around, people who are into grains, but for me, I happen to be allergic to most grains, so it's, they just can't comprehend a life without bread. But I was in a similar position, being allergic to dairy, soy, and most grains. I call myself a compulsory carnivore. I really get tired of eating meat, but it's like, there's where my energy source is at this point in my nutritional path. So I certainly empathize with this idea of people having some almost religious fervor around what they think other people should eat.
Yeah,
would you agree with that?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, it doesn't just stop with food. I think food is the most subtle and in some ways the most obvious way of judging another person or judging anything on the planet. But it doesn't just end with food. I mean, you've got people telling you what to eat in order to look the way that they think you're supposed to look like. You've got people telling you who to sleep with. You've got people telling you what to think, what to say. It gets to a point where, stay out of my bedroom and get your hands out of my plate. I just want to sit down and eat and enjoy my life and be happy about who I am. And, it really is a difficult situation for somebody who does have something like food allergies or has a compulsive eating situation where, think about the type of judgment that we have on people that, celebrities, if they put on 5 pounds or if somebody hits a certain age and they start showing a little bit of, like they're just slightly older. And the amount of judgment that that somebody would get from that is almost crippling. And I've experienced it myself, being in this line of work and seeing it right in front of me, how I've had people coming to me where they were working with nutritionists in the past, they were working with doctors, and they were just afraid to go to their nutritionist because they just didn't want to deal. They would rather waste their money and pay the cancellation fee or whatever it was than it was to sit down with the nutritionist and objectively go over their goals and their eating habits and their food and so on and so forth, because they just couldn't deal with the fact that that person is kind of ruling their nutritional life with an iron fist. And I think we've all experienced that at one point where we would go to a restaurant with somebody and order something that we enjoyed, and that person would say, "You're going to eat that?" It's the funniest thing. Like I would go out to a particular restaurant, and let's say I'm there by myself, and a really attractive waitress would come over and start striking up conversation with me, and you know, and then she would ask me, "Oh, well, what do you do?" And I would look at her and say, "You don't want to know." And she's already thinking, "Oh, was this guy like in the mafia or something?" And you know, and then she's like, "Oh, really, really? What do you do?" And I pull out my business card and I hand it to her, and the last time this happened, the girl looked at it, and then she looked at me and she said, "You're eating this crap and you're a nutritionist?" I said, "I'm trying to watch a baseball game." So the way that I think about it is that, you know, food is meant for us to enjoy, meant for us to have a relationship with, and meant for us to have a certain degree of a sensual experience with it. It's not supposed to be something where somebody says, "You're eating this crap." And it's frustrating for me because if you take a look at all the different cultures in the world, one culture is always going to think their culture's food is crap. For instance, if you look at Northern Europe, they eat a lot of meat, a lot of dairy, drink a lot of vodka, and, you know, and then you look at, let's say, an Indian culture, which is one of the only cultures that has a whole stream of traditional vegetarian fare, one culture is going to think the other one is completely bizarre. And then you see it the same way in this country, where one person's diet is another person's, you know, existential angst. So the way that I try to approach this is like all the food that's out there has its own specific purpose, and it's based on the appropriateness for the individual and for what that individual wants. And some people need meat, like in the case of someone that's allergic to a lot of vegetarian protein. There are some people out there that really, really love certain things, and that's more important than whatever the consequences are. Like there's some people out there that just really enjoy hot wings or hamburgers or ice cream, and they're willing to deal with the consequences. And those people, if they're happy and that's what they want out of their life, then who am I to judge them for that?
Right. Well, that's a very uncommon approach for a nutritionist, I have to admit. Now, I worked with a personal trainer who thought she was a nutritionist, and she dictated my diet, and I followed it to a T, and the first 6 months, it was working great. I really cut my muscles. I was down to 14% fat, but it backfired because she had me on a completely fat-free diet. So after the 6 months, I ended up, my hair was fried, my nails were brittle, I was starting to have skin problems. I had no oil to even maintain healthy skin or hair. And this was a professional person who was very, very strict and had me believing that I had to eat this way or else.
Well, Veronica, that's really interesting that you say that, because there's no traditional diet in the history of mankind that was ever a fat-free diet. There's no low-carb traditional diet. There is no traditional diet anywhere amongst domesticated cultures that was wholly vegetarian. So when somebody's imposing something like that on you, what they're doing is they're imposing their own ideals on you. And then when they're that strict, almost to a point of being Spartan about it, what they're doing is they're projecting their own insecurities and their own problems onto you, which is something there's no room for that when you're trying to help somebody achieve their goals. What they're doing is they are helping you achieve what they want for themselves. And we have to eliminate that if we're going to help people get to where they want in their life. Instead of saying, "This is what I want for you. You need 14% body fat. You need 10% body fat, or this or that or something else." Instead of saying, "Well, what do you want? What type of experience do you want out of your food? What type of experience do you want out of your life? How do you want your body to be?" And a lot of times when someone would come to me and I ask them, "What do you want? Do you really, really want to lose the weight?" They would look me square in the eye. I'd say five out of eight times, I'd say more than 50% of the time, that person would come to me, mostly women. They would say to me, "No, I really don't want to lose the weight. I'm pretty happy with the way that I am, but I feel like I have to because the way that I look right now is not attractive to somebody else." And this is where you get the whole sensuality and sexuality subject and how it plays into this. And then I say to them, well, what's most important to you? How you feel about yourself or how you perceive other people may feel about you. And then then we get into the whole aspect of self-expression and self-acceptance. So the whole idea behind this is, why are we living our nutritional lives based on what somebody else wants for us as opposed to what we want for ourselves? I mean, we're the ones cutting the food, sticking our fork in it, and putting it in our mouths. Why are we expecting somebody else to go and tell us if what we're doing is the correct thing? So what I try to do is get people in touch with their own ability to determine this stuff, and then give them an objective education on nutrition and food. Like, for instance, this whole idea that a low-fat diet or a fat-exclusive diet is the only kind of diet, or any type of macronutrient-exclusive diet, and try to give people the tools they need so they can go and make the decisions for themselves.
You know, and it seems like these extremes really attract people. People are attracted to extremes. So I recently had a conversation with somebody who considers themselves a raw foodist. And what was really interesting about this conversation is I said, you know, I went on the raw food diet. I was eating nothing but raw food. And I found that it totally, you know, clogged me up. I wasn't going to the bathroom, right? So I talked to somebody who is Ayurvedic and my acupuncturist, and she says, you know, sometimes you might want to balance that with a few cooked foods. And I just tweaked my diet so that it's like 70% raw and has 30% cooked. And voila, everything worked great. I'm trying to explain this to this raw foodist who incidentally admitted that she hadn't eaten a raw food diet in 6 months, but she still believed it was the perfect way to eat, and that if only I would stick to it for another 6 months, it would work perfectly for me and I should stop eating cooked foods. Have you run into that kind of dogmatism from people around food?
Veronica, that's really interesting that you said that, because somebody making that kind of a statement to you sounds like someone telling you that you need to be a Christian, but they don't go to church on Sundays.
I know, doesn't it?
The way that a lot of these folks approach these things, when they try to impose religion, politics, philosophy, sexuality, nutrition, when they try to impose these things on you, you really have to kind of look at where the person is coming from and see why they are who they are. And if it's somebody that's like, well, I think the raw food diet is great for you, but I don't eat raw food. And then I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, there's two ways you can approach that. Either you can say, well, thank you very much for the suggestion. That sounds like a great thing, and I'll look into it. Or you can say, you're a hypocrite. How could you tell me that this is something that I should be doing when you yourself don't even believe it's going to work for you? And that's why I think we really need to get out of this whole thing of having a food fight with people and start saying, my way is the right way, your right way is the wrong way, even though I don't necessarily do the way that I'm telling you to do it, but I still think you should do what I say. Again, it's just like somebody saying, well, you know, you need to go and go to synagogue, but I'm not a practicing Jew. And the way that I kind of approach that is I try to take the whole religious aspect out of making food choices, where somebody has the opportunity to just make up their own mind as far as what they want based on what works for them. And you have to know what you want out of your life. If you know what you want out of your life, if you know what goals you want to achieve, then you'll know, you'll be able to incorporate certain foods in your life to get that kind of experience. Like, for instance, if you want to lose weight, there are certain foods and a certain mindset and a certain approach that you would want to take on in order to achieve that goal. If you wanted to reduce your cholesterol, if you wanted to have more energy, if you wanted to have better relationships, if you wanted to get a new job or whatever it is, there are always different types of food-oriented solutions that you can add into your pathway of achieving those goals. And
I want to check in real quick and see if your business partner, David, is still on the line. David, are you there?
Yeah. I'm here. I'm listening.
All right. Well, I want to check in with you and get your perspective on some of this, because in a minute we need to free up that line so we can get some other callers to come on. But what's your take on...
By saying that David is my fitness advisor, and he was a client of mine, and then we started working together because we really hit off great. So I'm glad he's here, and I'd love to hear his perspective on what we're talking about.
Go ahead, David.
Well, you know, I totally agree with Michael about, you know,
seems like we lost David there. Okay. Well, David, I hear you totally agree with Michael, and he makes a lot of sense, so.
Well, I kind of know what he was going to, what he was going to say, because we were just talking about this yesterday, about this idea about when somebody's working with a personal trainer, because David is a personal trainer, and he's fantastic, and he's one of the few that I've met that really incorporates a lot of the lifestyle ideas and a lot of what we're talking about here, and trying not to put so much pressure on somebody. And what happens is that we look at other people that have achieved certain things, and they're physically and aesthetically pleasing to the eye. They look great. And we look at them, and sometimes we kind of look within ourselves and say, I could never achieve something like that, because you know, I work 12 hours a day, or I have kids, or I do these other things. I mean, how much time is it
that
you have to devote to being
here? Michael, we have another caller. Caller, can you hear us?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Dave, again, my call dropped in back.
Is that you, Dave?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, and our producer just let me know we've actually got four caller lines here, so you don't have to hang up. Stick with us for the remainder of the show, and callers, if you want to call in and voice your opinion, you can reach us toll-free at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. And also, you can do what everybody else does. People love to send me messages on Facebook. So just look for Veronica Monet on Facebook, go to my wall, and you can just leave something on the wall, and I will read it on the air. Anyway, David, we were asking you what your take was on this whole idea of there being one right way to do food. What do you think?
Well, you know, like I was saying, I came into the picture because I'm Michael's fitness advisor now. I'm a fitness trainer over here in New York, and we met a couple of years ago. I went through his program, and he really opened my mind to the subject of emotional eating and this whole judgment and how just nutrition in and of itself is you know, is very much a personal choice and not a dogma. So when I started to be more conscious of that subject, I noticed that my clients were very, very sensitive to, you know, to that judgment. Even just walking into the gym and feeling like, you know, a fitness trainer is judging that person so that they have to fit a certain type of body composition, a certain body type. And it really kind of threw me for a loop, because I always felt that, you know, that element was out of the picture. I just had to do my job and help the person lose the weight, but I really had to step into the role of being almost a life coach and a counselor, and Michael's helped me kind of be conscious of that. And it really is, you know, a very pertinent subject in this whole, not only in my whole realm, but everywhere in our culture. So I think it's a very pertinent subject.
You know, it's interesting to me as a sexologist. I feel like if it has anything to do with putting a smile on your face, our culture is hell-bent in making you frown.
Yeah, because happiness and smiles doesn't sell. I mean, when you go to the supermarket, I think this is really interesting that when you go to the supermarket, at the checkout aisle on one side, you have all of the health magazines like Shape and Woman's World and all this stuff and all the pretty pictures of like you know, Mandy Moore, Claudia Schiffer on Elle and Vogue and all this stuff, and on the other side you have all of the little mini cookbooks you know, you have like, you know, weight loss cooking or a miniature, you know, 30-minute meals type of thing. And then you have like, all these other tabloids and negative information like the Inquirer or the Globe or this stuff. So when you're at the checkout line and you have your food, you have all these different mixed messages that are being sent to you. And I think that's so amazing, especially there's one particular product, one particular magazine where they'll always have a title, lose weight on such and such diet, and then right underneath it they'll have comfort food recipes and a big picture of a pie. And right next to a really, really pretty woman, like literally like flawless looking. And I'm looking at this and like, well, we wonder why, you know, we have such a confused culture right now about their body image. And,
oh, yeah.
And you look at this and you see, and it's just, well, what are you trying to tell me here? Like eat comfort food, but I have to lose weight and I need to look like that. What do I do here? Could somebody please tell me what is expected of me so I could just do it? Because I don't know based on this. And then I've had so many experiences myself or with clients of mine or even in relationships where those mixed messages were just coming right out.
Michael, you've written several books about this, and the one that I read here is called Feeding the Pain. And what I love about your holistic approach is that it's not like you're just saying, okay, well, we need to, you know, have tolerance for fat people and stop making fat, you know, this problem. And you're not just saying that everybody should be able to eat whatever they want. And yet you are, but you have such a balanced approach to this so that you really do address food addiction and how food is used to numb emotions and replace authentic, intimate experiences, and you go down that road, and then you come right back and celebrate being a food sensualist. And I remember, you know, when you and I were conversing, you caught me talking about cheating on my diet, and you said, well, as a polyamorous, you know, would I call it cheating if I had more than one lover? And I was like, no, I hate that word, cheating. So you're like going, well, why do you cheat when it comes to food? And I would love for you to talk a little bit more about finding that balance between not suppressing our emotions with food, but at the same time being able to celebrate our relationship with food. How does one do that?
That's really interesting that you brought that up. Let me see if I can plan my words carefully here. If there's any polyamorous relationship that every human being on this planet should have, it should be with food. There is so much variety, and the food that is out there just wants to be consumed. It just wants to be eaten, and it just wants you to enjoy it, and it wants to provide you with whatever kind of nourishment and nutrition it can. So if you kind of look at food that you eat as if it's a relationship, then you start having kind of this internal sort of communication with what you're eating. And if you kind of take a look at traditional cultures throughout history before we became a much more industrialized society, you would see that people would have a much deeper relationship with their food. For instance, Native Americans would have a deep reverence for any animal they would consume, and farmers would say that they were attached to the land, that they would never leave the land, that they were going to die on the land. And you know, when we go into a supermarket, we're kind of detached from that kind of mentality. And in order for us to have a stronger relationship about what we eat and about what we consume, we really have to be linked to the food itself. For instance, we need to kind of look at a big head of lettuce and be like, this is a beautiful head of lettuce. This is gorgeous. I can't wait to put this inside me. You know what I mean? And then when we look at like meat, what I actually did, when I was growing up, I actually was very kind of scared about getting my hands dirty, which was terrible. My dad was a mechanic and he's like, ah, you know, you're a wuss. You don't want to get your hands dirty. He's like, I just don't like to get my hands dirty, which is why when I played football, I was a quarterback, so, you know, like, I don't get hit that much, you know? I don't have to get my hands in the mud or get dirty or touch anybody or anything like that. So But when it came to food, I realized that I had to get my hands dirty, because if I was going to start cooking, I had to, you know, mess around with it. So what I would do is, and I apologize ahead of time for the vegetarians out there, but just remember, I'm allergic to soybeans, so we're even. But my apologies to the vegetarians and the vegans and the raw foodists out there, but what I would do early in my career, when I really, really started getting into cooking, I would go to the butcher that was down the road from where I lived at the time, and I would hand pick out whatever meat I wanted. Like, nah, that meat doesn't really feel good. I don't really like the way that one looks, but I want that piece right there. And I would take it home, and before I would go and cut it up, I would grab it with both of my hands and flip it, and I would kind of just get my hands into it. And I would touch it, and I would feel the meat itself and realize and recognize that this came from another living being, so I got to kind of have a little bit of contact with it. And that's one of the things that I did to help me have a more harmonious relationship with my food, is realizing that, you know, this was something at some point that was alive, and in order for me to perpetuate my own existence, I need to consume it. If I don't consume this, then number one, I'm taking myself out of the whole ecological structure, and number two, I'm going to get sick and die. So I'm going to have a relationship with this thing. So I got my hands dirty, and I realized that, you know, touching this flesh was intensely sensual. And I'm looking at this, and I'm like, I'm, you know, I have some sort of relationship with this. So then I started saying, what does this meat want to be seasoned with? I'm like, I went and I picked out different things. I'm going to get some pepper, going to get some paprika, going to get this and that, maybe some rosemary. And then I would season it, and I would cook it, and I would eat it. And for some reason, it started to taste better and better. And I started doing the same thing with grains. Whenever I would dry roast a grain, I would get over the dish, and I would smell it, and I would experience it, and I would look at it, and the grain would tell me, I'm done. And then I would go and transfer. I don't use things like timers or anything like that anymore, because unless it's the first time I'm cooking something and I need to kind of get an idea because I'm making a recipe, going to give it to somebody. But when I go and I make my own kind of cooking adventure, I'm not following any rules. I'm having direct dialogue with the food itself and with the meal and letting it speak to me. You know, carrots are going to tell me when they're done. They're going to be bright, and they're going to be soft, and they're going to, you know, there's going to be a sort of aroma coming from it. And okay, well, it's done. And the same thing whenever I would cook onions or like if I was going to make a salad, and, you know, and I'd say, well, okay, well, I have a big green bowl of lettuce here, and what other colors can I add to this to make it more complete? Like if I was going to paint a picture, what colors would I add to this canvas that I have in front of me? So if you take that kind of mentality, it doesn't matter what diet you're on. It doesn't matter what nutritional approach you have or what dietary philosophy you have, you're always going to be effective with it because you're going to be thinking in terms of what is going to be the most harmonious experience here. What am I going to get out of this? Especially when you approach it from the standpoint of colors or sensory stimulation. So I guess the whole idea of being a food sensualist, the most important part of that is the prefix of sense or senses. So I guess it's not sensualist in the sense where, you know, it's sexual. It's sensual in the sense where the entire experience of food and eating and nutrition is encompassing all of my senses, the way the sense of smell, taste, hearing. You know, the sense of hearing is really important, too, because think about how cool it is when you hear it, when you're in the movie theater and you hear popcorn popping.
Oh, yeah.
And then you smell it, and then you're like, well, I got to get some popcorn. I don't care if it's $13 for 3 ounces. I'm going to go and get some popcorn. So the sense of sound is also really important, very, very subtle. And obviously the visual and then the way things feel, physically feel. And on top of that, it's probably the sense of smell. And the sense of smell is the most evocative of all senses. And if you can create an environment that incorporates all of the senses, and then you get into the intangibles of it, like what the food itself represents, especially what it represents to the individual, then you're creating an experience that goes beyond protein, carbohydrate, and fat, where the food actually becomes a living being that can actually stimulate me or stimulate you. And that, the whole idea behind living foods, I kind of look at that as if it's interpretive, where, okay, well, this food over here, yes, it's technically living because it's a,
you know, like something like blue green algae or something similar to that, or fermented foods.
That's technically living, but when you take it into consideration where you look at food as if it's going to be something deeper than that, something more spiritual and something more philosophical, any food, anything that you create in and of itself is going to have its own sort of life to it, because you're going to be putting part of your own energy into it. And
well,
that's,
you know,
how
Michael,
I interpret vibrational cooking is putting your own energy into something.
Yeah. Michael, I had some interesting experiences around food when I started eating organic food. Now, you know, if some people don't appreciate organic food. I happen to really love organic food. And not all my food is organic, but vast majority of it is. And they've done studies where the organic food actually has more energy in it. And not all organic food, I don't think, because some of these stores, I don't know where they're shipping their organic food from, but it seems like it's been around too long and it's kind of half dead. But if you go into a local co-op like the one I'm a member of, where they are using local farmers, then the food has got just an amazing amount of energy in it, and you could see it, you could smell it, you could taste it. And, you know, it could just be psychosomatic, but I really feel like there are more enzymes and more life in it when I actually bite into it.
Well,
so, go ahead.
I can understand where you're coming from with that. I mean, organic food does contain more nutrients because the soil that it comes from is just going to be more substantial. But here's again, just to maybe play a little bit of devil's advocate with that, here is kind of a different perspective on that. There are stories of individuals who were in concentration camps who were literally starved to death. They were given things like grass and, you know, scraps of bread, scraps of meat, and just stuff that you and I would look at and say, I can't eat that. And the miraculous part about this is that there are people who survived on that for years and years and years. I remember a story about one of the individuals who created the first multivitamin. He was in a concentration camp, and the way that he survived was he took rusty nails, put it in water, and then took grass and kind of broke it up and put it in the water, and he drank it, and he survived until he was released. And there's also stories of individuals that were in concentration camps that used certain types of chewing techniques to get more out of their food. So the way that I see it is that even with this idea about now I'm certainly not someone that's going to recommend that anyone take conventional pesticide and GMO food over organic food. But the way that I look at it is that there are a lot of people in this country who don't have access to organic food. And we can't put judgment on them because of that. Instead, we need to give people the opportunity to get the most out of their food from the particular position they're in. And remember, too, there are people in other parts of the world who don't have the kind of abundance that we have. And there is a certain degree of judgment in the organic wellness community, which I'll get into hopefully before the end of the show. But when you take a look at organic food, yes, statistically and scientifically, it's more substantial than conventional food. And yes, when you have genetically modified foods, you have a higher incidence of adverse reactions to it, maybe something that's probably an underlying cause of cancer. And then when you take into consideration pesticides, where most of those things are chemicals that have been known to kill laboratory animals. But the way that I approach it is that, you need to find what works for you. And some people find that organic works for them because it, right now at this point it works in their budget, or it doesn't work in their budget. They're part of a co-op and they have access to that kind of food. But somebody that's maybe in the inner city somewhere and the only source of real nutrition they have is a McDonald's or a fast food joint, then if we start demonizing that kind of, if we start demonizing that worse than it really is, but if we start demonizing that food, then what we're doing is we're demonizing the people that eat that food. Because if you are what you eat, then if you're saying that food is bad, well then what are the people that eat that food? Are they going to be bad people because they eat that? So a lot of times what happens, and when you get into these movements, what happens is it alienates people who are outside of the movement, and then you lose sight of what you're trying to accomplish. And the
right.
Michael,
I wasn't talking from the standpoint of being part of the organic movement. But just from my own personal experience about eating organic food and some of the research that I've read about it, and I would think that there must be room for us to be able to express our own personal experiences about, you know, in my case, I get deathly ill if I eat at McDonald's, and I feel fabulous and wonderful and vibrant and full of health when I eat organic food. That's my experience, and I would think it would be possible to talk from the personal without having to judge other people, just as my personal sex life does not resemble necessarily everybody else's sex life, thank God, and vice versa. Their sex life doesn't resemble mine, but, you know, as a sexologist, I find that neutral ground where I can be perfectly happy being a bisexual female who may have decided to marry a man and work as an escort, and at the same time understand somebody else who may choose to be celibate in an ashram somewhere in India. That those things do not have to shame each other by virtue of the fact that their adherents are expressing so much joy in choosing the path that works for them.
I say that we're in agreement about that.
Yeah.
I would love to see people have more of that choice and live their lives and not someone else's lives.
Well, one thing I would love to see you do is write this book, The Food Sensualist, because every time I hear you talk about your sensual relationship with food, it triggers a little bit of my internalized shame around food because, if sex is taboo, money is taboo, I think food is maybe worse as far as being something that you're not supposed to have fun with. But I don't know. What do you think?
Throughout history, food has been the most taboo thing, especially when you take the religious implications of it. There are stories in the Dark Ages of Christian monks, who would sit down to eat a meal, and they would take a handful of ashes and sprinkle it on the food so that they wouldn't enjoy the food. So that they would have a completely numbed experience to the food because they were supposed to keep themselves pure for their religious and spiritual goals. And you see throughout history, people getting, persecuted for what they eat. And you see how governments would use food as a means of controlling people. And you see it happening even right now. If you've got a starving population, then you've got people that are dependent on you. So you look at food and you see just how it is so connected to interactions between people. And you see also food with regards to sensual experiences, food and sex. For instance, there was that movie Like Water for Chocolate, where the way that the main character would connect with the man that she was in love with, who married her sister, she would be responsible for the family's food and for the cooking, and she would make these sensual dishes that she knew would be like her way of communicating with the man, and these were things that were just so overwhelmed with sexuality, not just the energy she put into it, but the, I mean, if you go and see that movie, you'll see that it was.
I have seen the movie, and is it true that chocolate is something of an aphrodisiac? Does it stimulate some neurons in your brain that actually do make you feel more sensual?
That's really funny. Food actually, I don't know if a true aphrodisiac really exists. But there are certain components in chocolate that mimic orgasm. they're kind of called exorphins, where they're similar to endorphins. When you would eat it, it would trigger like a mini orgasm, like a very, very small orgasm. And the darker the chocolate, the more it triggers this. And the interesting part about this is that
I love dark chocolate.
Here's the interesting part about this. Dark chocolate is much more potent when it's cooked, when it goes through the whole process of making the chocolate that we're familiar with. Whereas raw cacao, maybe from a nutritional standpoint, is much higher in antioxidants. These stimulant compounds like theobromine, caffeine, and these other chemicals found in chocolate are much more concentrated when it's cooked or when it's made into the chocolate that we're familiar with. The way that you'll see like 85% dark chocolate, like when it's turned into cocoa. But when you eat chocolate, especially when you're in a especially when you combine it with a sensual food like fruit, when you combine chocolate and strawberries, that I think is as close as you can get to a truly aphrodisiacal food. Because if you think about it, what does a strawberry look like when you split it down the middle? What does a strawberry look like? And then you pour chocolate over it. Yeah, and then you pour chocolate over that. I mean, how is that not arousing? You know, and if you think about it too, fruit is the sex organ of a plant. So you're combining the sex organs of a plant with something that stimulates these miniature artificial orgasms, and you put them together, and hey, that is literally a recipe for a truly sensual experience. But then you take it one step further, and you say, well, how do I make this so-called healthy food really sensual? What is the whole experience behind that? And that's where I, you know, I've had experiences where I've made like a completely vegetarian meal using something benign like millet and stir-fried vegetables, and had a really amazing sensual experience with a member of the opposite sex as a result of that. So a lot of it is the food itself, like chocolate. But a lot of it also is the intention behind it, like in that movie, like Water for Chocolate. But
and
chocolate is huge.
I have also noticed, Michael, that the way I prepare my food, like, you know, because I have food allergies, I lost some of the foods that I really loved to eat. Like, for instance, chocolate. I let myself eat that over the holidays. But the rest of the year, I really cannot do chocolate because it makes me very, very sick. So I've had to find other ways to have a sensual relationship with my food, and believe me, I'm just starting to embrace the concept, but I do see some areas in where I have started to celebrate my food a little bit more, really enjoy putting together something that is visually, appealing. So I'll choose colors that really spark my creativity, and I arrange it on the plate in such a way that I get really excited looking at it because of the way it looks. So don't you think that would be one way that you could also have a sensual relationship with your food regardless of what you are eating?
That is, but I'm going to challenge you here a little bit with a couple of questions. Okay, the first one. Have you ever met someone that you were really attracted to, but they weren't typically somebody that you would think is physically attractive?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like someone that just, for some reason, you just like, oh, I needed that.
Yeah, you know, yeah, exactly. Like, you go, I don't know what it is about that person, but I just find them really powerfully attractive, yes.
Right. Well, take that same approach and apply it to food. Well, just because something looks pretty doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be something that you're attracted to. So taking it from a visual perspective is not always the answer to creating a sensual experience with food.
Oh, well, tell us then what other modalities besides how it looks.
Well, I got another question for you. Have you ever actually made love to your food?
I would not have the slightest idea of what that even looked like.
Well, I mean, think about it in this terms. If you think about it, that a loving sensual experience, or let's say a loving sensual experience, is not necessarily something that's sexual. It's not necessarily something that involves body parts, but something that involves your spirit, and something that involves an innate connection with something, then you can make love in a million different ways, and you can create love in a million different ways. And if your relationship with your food is such that you are in a loving, connected relationship to it, then your interaction with it is, quote, making love by definition. So if you think about it in this way, if you try to use modalities, it's kind of like trying to spice up your sex life by going to the triple X store. But if you truly connect with what it is that you're eating, then you don't have to use any of these modalities. It'll happen, for lack of a better term, organically. It'll happen independent of anything that you try to impose unconsciously. It will just happen.
So are you talking about something that's the least bit related to the Native American concept of thanking the thing that died so that you can continue to live, or is that completely off base?
No, that's part of it. But it has to be something where, like what I was saying before, like about that that head of lettuce, is like, I can't wait to put that inside me.
No.
it's that same type of thing where it's like, you know, This is, I love this. I really love this, and I can't wait to eat this. Kind of like the same sort of excitement you would have is like, oh, I'm going on a date with a really hot girl right now. Ooh, this is going to be great. Instead, I'm like, I'm going to have braised beef tonight. This is awesome. I can't wait. You know, I'm cooking it, and I'm waiting, and I'm tapping my foot, and I'm like, when is it going to get here? Come on, come on. You know, kind of like if you're really, really attracted to somebody and you just like, gotta get you out of your clothes. It's the same thing as like, I gotta start cutting this up and I gotta chew this. Why do I have to chew this? Why can't I just consume it? It's the same thing. And if you really look at it, the brain chemistry is very similar. The whole idea, the brain chemistry and the idea of consuming something is very, very similar to the brain chemistry of consuming something in a sensual sense.
Is it really?
Yeah, I mean, for some, think about the whole food addiction thing, where people would be allergic to foods that they would be addicted to, and that brain chemistry, or they would be addicted to foods they're allergic to, and that brain chemistry is almost identical to the addiction of alcoholism or heroin addiction. So that's a whole other situation. We start talking about peptides and macromolecules and protein and endorphin receptors and so on and so forth.
That's actually sometimes how you can even tell you have a food allergy, is you start feeling like you have to have a particular food, and that can be like a sign that you might be actually have an allergy to it.
Right. That's one of the signs, and that's something that would make you want to consider testing. But if you really think about it, food is really the first expression of love that we have in our lives. And it's done through breastfeeding.
Right.
And that's where the origin of...
Bring it home for us, Michael. Okay. Breastfeeding. Go for it.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, you know, that's the first time that we ever really experience love, is when we are being fed. And if you think about it, we never lose that feeling as we continue, or we never lose that innate feeling as we grow up. We just become detached from it. And it's something that when we reattach ourselves to that innate feeling of food is love, or love is food, then we're capable of achieving a little bit more happiness and joy in our lives, and our food becomes a very powerful, nurturing and nourishing relationship, as opposed to a trepidatious relationship where our food is our enemy. And then it starts carrying over into a lot of different things. But when you start talking about food and love, it's something that goes a little bit deeper than just, quote, what modality is going to work in order to induce this. It's kind of trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, where you're trying to kind of force the idea that, okay, well, this is going to be something because this is by the book. And no, it's not about that. You have to kind of look at it as if you take all of your preconceived notions and all of your ideas about what food and nutrition and eating is supposed to be, and you just throw it out the window, and you say, that's not me. I didn't come up with those things. What does this really mean to me? Just like when you look at a picture like the Mona Lisa, you're asking yourself, what does this mean to me? How does this relate to me? It's the same thing with your food. How am I relating to this? What is this thing saying to me? How is it speaking to me? So almost like, you could say I'm the food whisperer. I don't know. You hear all these types of things all the time, but when you look at this and you see that the type of excitement that a food sensualist would have about their next meal is the same thing when they start thinking about sex. It's like there's no difference. In fact, they would relate to sexuality through using food analogies. Like, I want to eat that up, or God, I'm going to swallow that. Or like, you know, like, and you even think about even a lot of things with sexuality, how, you know, it involves the mouth. I mean, what's the mouth's primary function? To put food in it. And you think about our tongues, and you think about all these things, and, you know, now we're going to PG-13.
You're absolutely right.
Rated R.
I've got to tell you, I hope that you are Twittering, too, or go over to my Twitter site, Michael, because I Twittered some really great sound bites from you today. One of them was, stop the food fight. There is not one right way to eat. Find a way which works best for you. Another was, have a polyamorous relationship with food. Don't limit yourself or call it cheating. Be a food sensualist instead. And our first love experience is being fed at the breast, and what a sensual feast it is. We need to recapture this love for eating. So as we're getting towards the end here, I want to make sure people know how to contact you. I have Twittered your website several times, staffoflifenutrition.com. That's staffoflifenutrition.com. Did you want to tell people a little bit more about your services and how they can contact you, Michael?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's like I got to wipe some of the sweat off of my brow. That was intense. I just love talking about this stuff.
I know you do. I know you do. But I'm here to make sure that you actually get to market yourself a little bit too, you know?
Well, as far as my services, the way that I define myself is a holistic nutrition consultant. And I believe each person is different with different needs, different goals, different dreams. And I design a program to meet those individual needs and to show my clients how to achieve their goals. No two programs are ever identical. And I don't believe in drugs or invasive surgery or fad diets, which is something that I'm notorious for tearing the shreds. My approach is rooted in natural law and combined with scientific information, and it's intuitively applied. So it's a kind of a balance between a cerebral approach to nutrition and a personalized, intuitive, emotional approach to nutrition. So like you said before, I'm split right down the middle. And I truly believe in the divine healing quality of the human body and the strength of the human spirit. My obligation is to my clients and to what's best for them. And the way that I approach this is very different than other nutritionists. I use food allergy testing and spend a lot of time with a food mood journal where we look at not just food, but how you feel from what you're eating and how it's making you feel a couple of hours later. And then we cross-reference that with the food allergy reports. With my in-person clients, we do cooking classes, which is like an adventure and another stuff, because I'm always dropping something. It's like if Jerry Lewis was going to do a cooking class, that's me. But it's so much fun, and we have such a great time. And you see that you don't have to be perfect in order to eat healthy. And every time you make a mistake, that mistake is just an opportunity to a new realm of flavor. Sometimes you can add too much of one spice to a dish. And it's like, I didn't need to add this much spice, but actually it's pretty good. And then I teach people how to shop, and usually spend about 3 months with a client. And we do a lot of phone consultation, conference calls. So it's a combination of an education, an objective education based on scientific information and based on traditional information. And then also it's a process of attaining your goals. So it's not just about learning about food. It's learning about how different foods interact with you. So I have a different relationship with each one of my clients, which is why I don't usually work with a lot of them. And, you know, you have situations where to go to a counselor in Manhattan or in one of the, you know, like a conventional nutritionist, it can cost you sometimes $400 for a consultation. It averages out to about $150 per consultation with a nutritionist, and I'm far below that in the grand scheme of things. And I'm the kind of counselor where I will not say to somebody, okay, well, pay me for a consultation, I'm going to give you all of your answers. No, it's the type of thing where if somebody just wants to get a quick fix, I'm going to send them someplace else. But if they really want to achieve what I call nutritional independence and be somebody that can make their own decisions without seeking outside influences, then they're the right person to work with me.
Oh, that's really great. I love that. Nutritional independence. Hey, I'm looking at the Facebook here. We have a Samuel Krivik. He loves the idea of having a polyamorous relationship with food and never calling it cheating and becoming a food essentialist. So we got a thumbs up out there on Facebook, which is nice. And we are going to have to wrap up the show. David, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Hey, David. Thank you for joining us, too. You've been kind of our silent partner here today. and Michael, you are just, you're bubbling with enthusiasm and joy about what you do, and I can't thank you.
I'm in love with my food. I mean,
I know. And life. And life. You're in love with life. You love what you do, obviously, too.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I love seeing my clients achieve their goals. I mean, that's what makes it all worth it for me, because, just like I think from your standpoint, when you see somebody that improves their relationship with themselves in whatever modality they may be pursuing, it makes you feel better. It makes you feel like your purpose is being fulfilled. And when I'm talking to somebody, and there was a client that I had from years ago.
But we got to cut it down. You have amazing stories. We're going to have you back on the show, Michael.
Well, then I could just do all anecdotal stories there, because I have hundreds of them.
I know you do. I know you do. When you get your next book out, let's have you back on to talk about that, okay?
Well, yeah, I've got it all in the works right now, and I'm updating two of them, one on the emotional eating and one on the food allergies. So one very cerebral and one very emotional.
Yes, okay. That's all for today.
Thanks very much, Veronica. It was an honor to be on the program with you and love the work that you're doing.
Thank you, Michael. Right back at you. You're awesome. So that's it for the Shame Free Zone. If you want to find out more about Michael Joseph, please go over to staffoflifenutrition.com. As you can see, he's very exuberant about this new paradigm in food. So we'll check in with you next Saturday. Bye, Michael. Bye, David.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian.